Hey there! You're listening to Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 229. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me today, Greg Leahy.
Ahoy, ahoy, everyone.
And John Lindemann.
Contributing editor, John Lindemann.
That's right, ex-director of NintendoWorldReport.com, John Lindemann. James is not here at the moment, but he is going to be showing up after the break for listener mail. So we'll be doing new business without him. And first off, I guess, you know, John, we could talk about this, but you have some pretty big new business in that you are no longer the director.
Yeah, I am no longer the director. The director is now Neil Ronahan, as I refer to him, the Rana Man. And this has been kind of...
You should be ashamed of yourself for that. Keep repeating it in every venue you have the chance to.
And nobody thinks it's funny. That's what I love about it. But yeah, so this has kind of been in the works for a little while. From a time standpoint, personally, professionally, it's just pretty much, it's like I just didn't have a lot of time to devote to all the various things that need to be done to the website. So I figured, somebody else should take the reins and, you know, give the site the attention it deserves and also, you know, bring some fresh ideas to the table, maybe different ways to do things. It's all well and good. And so Neil took over, a couple of days ago?
Yeah.
And that's it. So, you know, he's already making some good changes and getting some stuff done. So it's all good.
Yeah, I have great confidence in Neil, and I think he's going to do a great job. And, you know, I mean, if you want to go hear more about that from the man himself, you can probably listen to Newscast. I'm sure they'll be talking about it in addition to their 3DS hands-on coverage and stuff like that. But enough of promoting their podcast. How about our podcast?
Damn right.
Because we're pretty hot shit, too. I don't know if you knew this, but people listen to our show.
We're kind of
they
a
really
big
like
deal.
It, too. I don't know why, but they really do like it. Maybe it's because we talk about video games on this show.
We talk about Nintendo video games.
Well,
even though not me this week, but...
Yeah, well, out of the three of us, I'm going first because I do actually have Nintendo games to talk about. So I rented a Wii game called Final Fantasy Crystal Chronicles The Crystal Bearers, and holy shit, that game is a mess. I mean, it is a hot mess. No,
yeah.
Actually, it's not a hot mess. It's just a mess.
Hot garbage.
I think it's kind of trash. I mean, I really do. Like, I played it for, I have to admit, I didn't play that much of it. I played it for like 2 hours and just stuck it right back in the envelope for Gamefly because I was like, what is this shit? I mean, it looks nice. The graphics are definitely top tier for Wii. They look good. The music is nice. It has one of these kind of off-kilter soundtracks where they use some kind of interesting instruments. And, you know, it doesn't sound super epic and sweeping like you would get out of a mainline Final Fantasy game.
Yeah.
But the Crystal Bearers, the gameplay makes no sense at all. And the game seems like the designers never could figure out how they wanted it to play, or they decided that the core gameplay of walking around and using your telekinesis to throw stuff around the environment didn't actually make that much sense and didn't really work for a full game. So they keep, there's a lot of like on-rail shooter parts that they squeeze in there for like, they're basically cinematic events, but you know, you have stuff that you can shoot or whatever. And, it's a mess.
Yeah. Is it aimed at a younger audience? It sounds like that one Pokemon game where the Pokemon camera game.
No, it's not really like Pokemon Snap. It's actually a little bit like Elebits, except it's in third person.
I suppose that's appropriate given that it was probably supposed to come out at a similar time as Elebits once upon a time.
Elebits was almost a launch game, so...
Yeah, we heard about Crystal Bearers about as early as we heard about any Wii games, but
that's
it
true.
Just kept getting delayed and delayed, and bit of a disaster-type situation, aptly
It
enough.
Does have... I mean, it really does feel kind of like a broken development project. You know, it feels like they kept starting it and restarting it and scrapping things, and it at the end it feels like a lot of pieces of games that they kind of smashed together because it just doesn't make any damn sense when you play it. And as far as I can tell, the actual core gameplay where you're walking around and picking up things, you point at the screen and you pick things up with your crystal power, which is basically like telekinesis, like in Elebits. And then you can like sling it all over the place. And that's how you kill enemies. You basically just smash them into each other or smash them into the ground or pick up rocks in the environment and throw those at the enemies. It's all really kind of the same thing. And it's not fun. It's really tedious, and the controls aren't good enough, and it's a very indirect way of doing things, you know, because your character never actually interacts with anything. He's always picking things up with his mind or whatever, with his powers, and using those to attack things. And so it feels really disconnected from what you're doing. It actually reminded me also of the Ghostbusters game, which I rented on Wii, and I didn't really care for that either. I think it works better in Elebitz because Elebitz is in first person, so you don't have all these camera things going on, but damn, the camera's really bad in Crystal Bearers. I mean, terrible. And the voice acting is... it's like from the dregs of Saturday morning anime. I mean, it's just horrible, really.
What's the story like? Is it equally terrible?
I mean, the story, you know, it's one of those things. I mean, it's very anime in that they kind of throw you in there without explaining anything, and these characters just seem very brash, and they run around. They've all got attitudes about everything, and, you know, I can't tell where it was going. I didn't play the whole game, but I thought the story was mildly interesting, except the characters are all completely obnoxious.
Yeah.
So I wasn't really curious to see the rest of it, especially with how that game was playing. I mean, James was right when he talked about this about a year ago, and he said, you know, it's definitely not an RPG, but it's hard to kind of figure out exactly what kind of game it is, and I don't think the guys who made it know what kind of game it is either.
Yeah.
The fact that it's unclassifiable isn't necessarily a bad thing, but it really just feels messy. I mean, it just feels sloppy and disorganized, so I didn't play that for very long. I did finish Final Fantasy 13.
Which you played for somewhat longer.
Yes, somewhat longer. So, in summation, I do like that game. I ended up sinking about 10 more hours into side quests. I wasn't grinding, just like walking in a circle to fight the same enemies over and over. I went and did things I hadn't done before, and they were pretty interesting. I found out you can ride chocobos. I found this out 60 hours into the game that there's a side quest you can do that lets you ride chocobos. And then that makes it a lot easier and faster to get to other side quests. And it lets you access side quests that you can't get without them. So I was like, oh, okay, well, maybe I will keep playing this for a while. And I did. And then when I finally did go back to the final boss, I beat him pretty easily. And the ending's kind of predictable. It's very pretty. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
It's like most Square Enix stuff. I had to laugh at your email, though. You were like, yeah, I wrapped this one up, you know, pretty quickly. 10 hours after doing some side quests, I was like, okay, I guess you have a different way to define quickly.
Well, you know, I mean, I'm between you, John, and James.
Yes.
I mean, for James, 70 hours is nothing. For me, it took me almost a year to play it that much.
Yeah.
So I'm finally done with it. There is more stuff I could go do, but I'm not going to. But I am looking forward to 13.2, and I hope that my completed save file will be worth something. I don't know that it will be, but supposedly the 13.2 takes place immediately, almost immediately after 13. Mm-hmm. It's mostly the same characters, it's the same place, they're just all kind of doing different things, and the game plays somewhat differently. So
yeah,
I'm looking forward to finding out more about that. It's supposed to be out before the end of the year in Japan. So probably, you know, early spring next year for us.
Who knows? Maybe it'll be on the Sony NGP. Heyo! Heyo!
Well, we're going to talk a little bit about the whole PSP2 thing a little bit later. But I want to wait till James gets here because I'm sure he has something funny to say about
it. But we all know what James will say. He loves Sony. I mean, I get tired of his fanboyism.
He's such like a James. PS3 fanboy.
He is.
Yeah.
I know. He's such a fanboy.
He doesn't even own one. I also finished Professor Layton 3, The Unwound Future. January is traditionally my finish games month. It's where I go back and like revisit a lot of things I played the previous year and actually finish them, complete them, or I try to. And so I'm very happy with my results lately. I finished Donkey Kong, I finished Final Fantasy, I finished Layton, and I finished something else too, I forget. But Layton 3, you know, it doesn't change that much from the start to the end of it. And, you know, I guess James had made some comments earlier about how completely ludicrous and incredible the ending sequences. And, I mean, I'd say it actually took me about 20 hours to play through that game. So I apparently am much slower than James. I don't know if that's slower than average, but... it ended up being about 20 hours, and the last couple hours are freaking ridiculous. I mean, just the story goes completely off the rails. It's weird because the setting of Layton and the style of it seems kind of grounded when you start. Even this one, I was surprised that they start the game off by having you travel through time. That's the premise of the entire game, and it seems out of character for the Layton series because, you know, for the most part, the series seems to be more or less grounded in some version of reality. You know, it doesn't seem to just make up its own rules all the time and do totally crazy sci-fi stuff. And yet, the first game, by the time you get to the end of it, it is actually pretty crazy and unbelievable, and this one is far more so. I mean, by the end of it, it's just that the plot twists in ways that no one could predict because it's completely absurd. And a lot of what happens hinges on Professor Layton knowing things that no one could really possibly know, because he's just apparently so smart that he's done all this research while you were walking around the street. He's done all this background research on all the other characters, and so he knows exactly what's going on all the time.
Professor Layton is the Joker.
Yeah, yeah. He makes his own clothes, apparently. And you don't want him around pencils.
Ta-da!
So, I definitely enjoyed Professor Layton 3, but again, I feel like, actually, there are hints that the next one is maybe going to take place in America. I mean, it's somewhere overseas, but overseas from England means, what, Iceland, Canada, or America, probably, because otherwise you'd probably go east. So, I'd say America is likely, but yeah, that seems to be, it seems to be pointing in that direction. I don't know that that's going to be more interesting.
The thing is, though, isn't the next one in the sequence of games that actually come out, Devil's Flute, isn't that a prequel? Don't you get even younger Luke and stuff?
Oh, God, so, really?
Ugh. I guess if Layton does go to America, eventually we're going to have to wait quite a while to get to that point.
You know, I like that series. You definitely learn more about Professor Layton. He seems like a more human character in this one. But at the same time, the stuff he does is so fantastic that, you know, no one could actually know that stuff or actually do that stuff. So, I don't know. That series is so weird. The tone of it is just all over the place. It never kind of turns out the way you would expect it to. So, maybe that's a good thing. And then finally, I played the Bulletstorm demo on Xbox, and this game is from the Gears of War people, basically. They're publishing it. It's on the Unreal Engine 3. And I just had to bring it up because it reminded me of all that, you know, all the Killzone stuff that you guys love to quote, eat my bullets, and that, man, Bulletstorm is so much more over the top than Killzone.
It sounds
2.
Like, you know, like Cliffy B finally said, okay, you guys always make fun of how my games are so bro-y, I'm going to make the most bro-y game I could possibly make.
It's basically a joke about itself being so bro-y. You know, like, mm-hmm. The game is just so completely absurd that it's kind of meta, I think. It's almost ironically bro-y, because the stuff they say is just ridiculous. I mean, you can grab a guy with your energy lasso, bring him over to you, shoot him a couple times, and then kick him if he's turned just the right way in midair. And if you kick him right in the butt, you get a bonus points with the title Boot in the Poop Shoot. And that's how completely insane this game is. It's funny, but it's the kind of funny that you almost kind of feel bad about laughing at, because it's, you know, it's so lowbrow that it's, I don't know. But, I mean, it's like Duke Nukem and Killzone 2 and all that stuff mashed together and then just amplified several times over. It's completely ridiculous.
Like, how does it differ from Gears of War?
Well, it's a first-person shooter.
Oh, okay. It
plays somewhat differently. There's much less emphasis on cover, it seems, from the demo. And it just plays a lot faster than Gears. And it's point-based. I mean, it's very arcadey.
Okay.
So, you know, even in the single-player modes, basically the goal, it's almost like a score attack. It's like, kill these guys as creatively as possible. There's tons of environmental stuff. It looks really good. I mean, I don't know if it's the kind of game I want to get right at launch, but I would probably enjoy playing through it quite a bit. So I don't know if I'll rent it or maybe try to wait for it to come down in price or what, but I think I will like it. I just wonder if the style of it's going to wear really thin by the end.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Maybe you could tolerate that for an hour or something, but
I don't know. It depends on how clever they are with it, you know. But man, it just keeps throwing stuff up on the screen that you just can't believe they went there, because it's just so outrageous. But yeah, Bulletstorm, it seems like it's going to be pretty good, actually.
Like, is the goal of it for score attack?
Well, there is a campaign, but you can also play through chapters in the campaign over and over again to get the high score, so it has leaderboards and everything. And there's a multiplayer mode, too. I think it might only be co-op in multiplayer. I'm not exactly sure. So anyway, ladies and gentlemen, joining us on the podcast now, via satellite, is Storm City James.
Wow. Seriously?
Yeah, that just happened, James.
Yeah, that's going to end real badly for the site if I start getting Storm City Games copies. I'm going to make Jeff Shirley look civil.
Wow. And James, did you have anything you want to bring up on new business?
Just an update to both the games I talked about last week, I guess. So I've blitzed through 007, and the single player is actually really fun. I have no idea why they felt the need to hide it from us during various trade shows.
I felt the same.
It's pretty confounding. I expect it to be dreadful considering how much they hit it. And I'm also kind of shocked that the fact that the game actually looks pretty good despite the fact that all the media they released for the game initially looked really bad. I don't quite get it. And then the other game, obviously, was 999.
Are all your people dead yet?
So I made the biggest jackass decision I could possibly make, like right after we stopped recording last week. I figured, all right, this is the jackass decision, so maybe this is what they were trying to hide the good end behind. No, it was pretty apparent immediately that was the bad end, and I had to restart from a previous save. And I'm pretty much at the end of the game now, and I'm just decided I'm getting a terrible ending, and I just have to deal with it. But it's gotten better. I'm much more tuned into the story as the various pieces of plot have come into play.
How long would you say it is? I mean, if you're getting near the end now.
Probably about 9-10 hours. It'll be faster in subsequent playthroughs because I can skip through the dialogue.
So, I mean, do you feel pretty sure that you're going to play through it multiple times?
I think I have to, because at this point there's a bunch of questions that I have a feeling they're deliberately not going to answer that I want to see answered. And also, if I get the terrible ending, though, I might set it down for a little while. Because I did set it down for a day or two because I was like, man, that was just bad.
It's too much. Too intense.
Too much. And the joke was when I went back and picked a different route, they still made me confront the badness of the other route, just not as directly. I was like, damn it. I don't want to see this again.
Well, Greg, why don't you tell us about that?
That was Johnny's attempt at a Transformers sound effect.
Oh.
Oh my god. I thought it was something totally different.
That wasn't so bad, was it?
Well, we'll have to look back at the tape. As NFL coaches say, I haven't seen the tape yet, so I don't want to comment on that.
You can possibly edit in the real thing for reference.
I feel like I should correct him, but I think that would just take it down another notch.
No, John, let me hear your version. Let me hear yours.
Yeah, well, you've put yourself in his body.
Sonic
John.
Wizard. Let's hear it.
I don't remember you being in Police Academy, John. Come on.
I was trying to remember that character's name.
A little bit better.
But yeah, better,
a little bit
better.
True to the cartoon. Still,
you know, I feel like it's appropriate that with Transformers managed to come up this episode because I've always seen James and John's relationship as being very much like Megatron and Starscream's. You know, John is the he's the embattled veteran grizzled leader, and James is the loud, insolent sort of lieutenant who constantly bickers with him and doesn't do what he says, and yet somehow they still work together for some reason.
Yeah.
And also James blows a lot of fire out of his ass.
And coincidentally, my arm actually does have a huge sight from a gun on it, so.
But of course that means I did suspect that, you know, this whole director changing power thing would end with James kicking John's lifeless body into space only for John to be resurrected by Orson Welles as Leonard Nimoy. But luckily that has not happened.
I should be so lucky.
Give it time,
it's not too late.
Give it time.
So, yeah, in case you haven't noticed, I really like the animated movie of the Transformers from the 80s. It was like one of the first films I ever saw. I can remember seeing it anyway. I was too young to see it in the cinema, but we had it on VHS and I saw it and I thought it was awesome. Because, like, the cartoon, it's cool and all that from the point of view that, yeah, it's robots and they transform into stuff, but it's the same thing every week, at least early. It's basically like, what kind of energy source is Megatron going to rip off this week? Mm-hmm. And it just plays out. And then when you see the movie, it's completely insane because people are just dying left and right. Like, about 5 minutes in, Megatron just blasts off a recurring character's face. And it's like, oh, they're not messing around.
Yeah, that's what I like about it, is that they just completely destroy any continuity with the series.
Yeah.
You know, because they're like, yo, this is the fucking movie. We're going to do it for keeps. You know, like, this is the movie. It's going to stand alone.
I guess it's mainly for the most cynical reasons you could possibly imagine, which is just that they wanted to sell a bunch of toys. So they just killed off the existing characters so that you could have this replacement wave of stuff like Hot Rod and Galvatron and all that stuff. So
Hot Rod, Jesus.
There was a very calculated motive beneath it. But, you know, when you're a kid, you're not thinking about that. It's just, it seems so amazing that all this stuff is actually happening. So that always stuck with me. And when the War for Cybertron game came out on the HD consoles last year, I kind of followed it with some interest because I always thought the idea of Transformers would lend itself to a game if executed properly. But there's been a lot of shit over the years.
It's tough because there's so many different kinds of vehicles. It's hard to make a game where all of those could kind of interface and play together, you know?
Yeah.
It seems very challenging to design.
And the way they've kind of approached that with this HD game, you know, it's a third-person shooter. You know, I guess it's similar stuff like Gears of War, which I haven't played. But they deal with the issue of like having all the different Transformers being quite different by narrowing it down considerably. When you play a same wave, surprisingly, he's not a hi-fi anymore. he's just like another kind of vehicle. You do get to play as Starscream, who's a jet, which it's definitely not as fast as a jet should probably be, but it is airborne, and you do get into some aerial combat with it where you have to do some barrel rolls to avoid fire. And so it does vary up the gameplay a bit in that way. But I think the main way in which it's successful is just the fact that you can, for instance, you might be in a situation where you're in a kind of firefight with snipers, and there's some of the environments are pretty impressive in scale. And where that kind of pays off is, you know, you'll be sniping a bunch of enemies, you'll get so far, they run out of ammo, and then it's like, all right, screw it, I'm going to transform into the jet, fly over there, and just smash his face off. And you could totally do that with a couple of clicks of the left analog stick, and it feels great, and it makes the size of the arenas kind of work from the point of view that on the one hand you can have this real rage combat, but on the other hand it can be traversed manageably without some interminable kind of journey across it, you know, at various times. So it works pretty well in that sense. The problem I kind of have with it is just that, you know, what they do with the core gameplay is not, or certainly has not been so far. I've played roughly about half the game because it's split between a Decepticon campaign and Autobot campaign. And I've pretty much done the Decepticon bit. And the thing is, you can do Autobots first if you want, even though chronologically it takes place afterwards in the story. So I'm not really expecting the Autobot campaign to like be way more intricate or different, considering you could do it first. So based on what I have played, it's pretty straightforward stuff, apart from the core gameplay having that kind of wrinkle of transforming. You know, you're shooting waves of enemies that'll come in, and then you can advance. And yeah, there's some nice set pieces. You have to fight like the gigantic Omega Supreme character for the Autobots, that's where you get a kind of boss fight that does make use of the mechanics, because he'll launch waves of rocket fire that you just can't avoid if you're the slow lumbering, you know, humanoid version of Megatron, for instance. But if you transform into the tank that he is in this world and sort of drive out of the way and then transform back, fire, and keep in that kind of cycle, you'll manage to survive. So it's getting there, you know. I think it's got the fundamentals pretty right, and I mean, I assume it could be quite a lot of fun playing it online, either like competitively or co-op, because I mean, whenever you play the one player game, you've always got a couple of your helpers alongside you. But in terms of, you know, the finer details and the sort of the more artistic kind of elements, in terms of, you know, level design, enemy design, it's a little bit boilerplate.
Do you think you'll actually play it online?
I might give it a go. The problem is at this stage, like, anyone who's left playing it by kind of natural selection is probably infinitely better at it than I could ever be. Yeah. So that's a little bit off-putting, but I still might try it just because it'd be interesting to see how that kind of plays out, you know, because that's the thing. Obviously, you could make spontaneous and creative use of transforming in and out of the different forms, but your enemies generally don't. Whereas, right. Yeah, if you're playing online against human opponents, that would make things quite a bit more interesting.
It's too bad that, you know, other developers can't make use of Nintendo's patented rival system that separates ninjas from babies online.
I don't, to be honest, I've not looked into the matchmaking or that kind of stuff. Maybe there's some things they do to aid that problem, but I kind of doubt it.
Probably not, yeah. All right, cool. Now, there was a version of the... I forget exactly what it was called, but there was a...
Is it called Cybertron Adventures? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I think it's mainly like an on-rail shooter.
Yeah, it's one of the unfortunate products of Next Level Games 2010.
So they made two on-rail shooters licensed for other companies last year.
Yeah.
And then they also made that Ghost Recon piece of shit.
Exactly. And they both got savaged, so...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Perhaps the less said, the better about it.
Yeah, I guess so. That's too bad. All right, John, you're going to wrap up new business for us.
Yeah, since I've now gone into retirement, living off of the massive amounts of money that I made as director of NWR, I have a bit more time to go through the backlog. I have a small backlog, mind you. I don't have too many games in there, but...
Really? How's Mass Effect 2?
Oh, I don't know. I'll get to it when I get to it.
How's Mass Effect 1?
Oh, I don't know. It's yeah. Kind of... It's all right.
Is there a Resistance piled up there somewhere?
You know, John, actually, now that I think about it, you probably should get Mass Effect 2 on PS3, because even though you already own it on 360, you could just play through that comic, and that way you could say that you beat Mass Effect 1 in about 20 minutes.
I did have that thought last week, but I did want to encourage him.
And out come the wolves.
Do you want to be an enabler? That's all. Is that the kind of person that you see yourself as?
I'm just saying, yes, he'd be buying one more game, but he'd also be taking one game off of his backlog. And with the minimal amount of effort.
There's only a payoff there if he actually would then play Mass Effect 2, because otherwise it just assumes the same role of being on the shelf.
But it's going to be on a shelf either way, so he hasn't really lost anything with the second
guys,
game.
Guys, I'm right
but
here.
But he's gained so much.
I can hear everything you're saying.
See, look, guys, you're missing the fact. The bonus reality is that because it's a new release, he'll get to pay A, full price for it, even though he won't play it in a while, and B, I think there's a collector's edition.
I'll be over here when you're done.
So in theory, this is the perfect scenario for John.
John, this is what happens when I ask you what games you've been playing, and you start off by talking about the games you haven't been playing. What are you actually been playing this past week in all your newfound free time?
Well, I saw that Dead Space 2 came out, and no, I did not get Dead Space 2, and no, I did not get the collector's super-duper version of Dead Space 2.
Yeah.
But I do have Dead Space, the first one, and... You know, as kind of one of my habits, I tend to play games for a few hours and then, you know, maybe shelve them for a little while.
It's now a good time to mention that it took me about 7 weeks to play through Dead Space, and I considered that a long time.
Mm-hmm. Dead Space is the kind of game that I could see someone playing for a while and then putting down, because it's not paced very well, if you ask me. I mean,
that's some of the reason why I took as long as I did over it.
So, John, I mean, but I guess you'd played some of it before, and now you're deeper into it. So what are your thoughts?
Well, actually, I'm liking it a lot, like, because one of the reasons that I kind of abandoned it, I didn't really know where it was going. It was just kind of, it seemed kind of pointless just walking around. The environments didn't really change that much. You know, a lot of corridor crawling, you know, monsters jumping out of, you know, vents and stuff like that. It's, you know, the story is kind of Bioshock-ish. It borrows elements from, you know, Bioshock, atmosphere-wise, sort of the Metroid series. Mm-hmm. You know, it really didn't hook me at first. I thought it was very well done, you know, graphically, and I thought, like, you know, I thought the atmosphere was pretty cool. But I decided, you know, I'll play through it, because I think I got maybe to like the second or third chapter, and now I'm through to the sixth chapter, which is I think halfway through. Yeah. And it really picks up after that. What really actually amazed me was how well. The environments were spaced out. Like, later on in the game, you get into environments that are like two or three stories tall, and there's a lot of, you know, vertical movement that you really don't see earlier on in the game. Earlier on in the game, it's just pretty much a corridor shooter, except with tank-like controls. But it gets pretty cool as you keep going, so I'm looking forward to seeing what else is at the end. And there's a lot of they do a really good job making it pretty creepy. Like, I don't think enough games kind of use sound the way they should, especially to make the environment creepy. Like, you know, you'll have a monster chase you and you know that you can't kill it and you'll run out of the room, but you can hear it actually kind of pursuing you as you go about your business elsewhere.
Well, I mean, I think we've... James, did you ever play Dead Space?
No.
Okay. Well, I know Greg and I both loved it, and I think it's a game that was overlooked by a lot of people, or maybe a lot of people intended to play it and didn't, because it didn't have great sales.
No.
Which is too bad, because it is a great game. It's basically like a sci-fi version of Resident Evil 4. So, yeah. I mean, you'd think that would be very appealing to a large crowd, and yet it never seemed to really find its fan base. So I was a little surprised that they made a sequel.
Yeah.
Well, they were always invested in this for the long haul, though, weren't they, with all the...
Well, comic books and shit. Yeah,
right. So. Yeah, this is a franchise move.
One thing I like about the second one, and I've only played the demo of it, but in the microgravity sections...
Yeah.
So in the first one, he has magnetic boots, kind of like in Star Trek First Contact. So he can kind of launch from one place to another, but he can't control himself in mid-flight. So, yeah. And occasionally they use that to kind of make things swim by you or even kind of launch out at you while you're floating. And there's nothing you can do about it except just try to shoot it back, you know. So that's pretty cool, and it's very disorienting because you're always kind of moving at these weird angles from one landing spot to another. But in the second one, you have these little little jets on your suit, so you can actually control yourself in three full dimensions, which really very few games let you do. And you're flying. It's kind of like a jetpack, except you can rotate in any direction. I mean, it's even more disorienting. It's actually maybe a little bit like what we could have expected out of Cosmic Walker if that game hadn't come to an apparently tragic demise.
Yeah, I mean, I thought the Zero G stuff, even in the first one, was really cool just because it wasn't just like they threw you in a room and you could bounce anywhere you wanted. Like, you kind of have tasks. Like, you go over to a wall and then use one of your skills to open something up in that wall.
It feels very strategic.
Yeah.
You know, like plotting your trajectory around this room. Like, how the hell am I supposed to get over there where I'm supposed to go?
There's some more protracted sequences later in the game where you're up against the clock a bit, and so it's very tense.
Because you're out of air.
You have such limited control, and, you know, you are kind of just helpless, just pinging from one place to the next. So it's good for tension. Potentially frustrating as well, but certainly tense.
Yeah. The one thing. Speaking of being frustrated, Neil was complaining about the load times on the PS3. The load times are pretty lengthy.
So, are you playing it on PS3?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, you might actually be interested in Dead Space 2 then, because I know that if you've beaten it, or maybe if you've just played it, I don't know if you have to beat the first one, but it does unlock some stuff if you play the sequel on the same system and it sees your save file. And then the PS3 version sounds like it is unequivocally the better version of Dead Space 2, because it has slightly better graphics, it ships on one Blu-ray instead of two DVDs on Xbox. And it comes with, at least if you buy like the initial run, it comes with a essentially free copy of Dead Space Extraction, the Wii game.
That's only the limited edition.
You don't have to pay extra for it. It's just if you buy the game now, if you pay $60 rather than wait until it's $30 in 6 months. But I mean, essentially they're giving out Dead Space Extraction to a lot of people, which I think is smart because, you know, if you played Dead Space 2, you probably played the first one, you probably care about that fiction and the gaps that the Extraction fills in. So that probably is the audience. And, you know, that game wasn't played by very many people on the Wii, so
yeah.
It's kind of nice to get it out there. I think Extraction's a little bit overrated, as I've said before, but it would be kind of neat to play it with slightly better graphics. I actually watched a comparison video between the PS3 and the Wii versions, and they didn't do much to it, let me tell you. I mean, it still looks kind of like a Wii game. It's technically running in high definition, but if you're not going to rewrite a bunch of textures and redo the lighting, then it doesn't mean much, you know?
Yeah.
So it still kind of looks like a Wii game, even on PS3, but you can play it with Move, which is...
Yeah, justify your Move purchase.
Yes.
Yeah.
I've been waiting. I've been waiting.
Isn't that a Madonna song?
Yes, I think it is.
So you get to justify it with a free game, a free
justify
download.
Justify my Move.
Swinging.
Playing. Oh, gosh. So,
yeah.
Et cetera. Anyways... So the other game I was playing also on PS3 is Shatter. They had the 50% sale, so...
Mm.
And Shatter, actually, I was really surprised. It actually got really good reviews. I think on Metacritic. It had like 34 reviews, and the lowest one was like 75. So, okay. Yeah, and it's like a brick breaker kind of Arkanoid type of game, but they really
breaking
do
blocks.
Some... Breaking blocks. And they do some cool stuff that in terms of control. You really have a lot of choice over how you score points. Johnny, you have Shatter too, don't you?
I do, yeah. I haven't played it in quite a while, but I like it.
Yep, it's good. I think it's a little bit overrated.
The thing is, people love the soundtrack to that game, but it's all like techno shit, and it doesn't do anything for me. It's just not interesting music to me, but everybody loves the music.
Yeah.
And the gameplay, I feel like it's just a little too hard to wrap your head around because it's always making you, you know, it's got your little bar that bounces the ball. Mm-hmm. It's always kind of moving like in an arc rather than left and right across the bottom of the screen.
Yeah, they really switch it up.
Yeah, and it's a lot of times I just found that it was difficult to figure out where the ball was going to go.
Yep.
So, I mean, it's like they're making it interesting, but at the expense of it, it no longer feels like a deterministic game. I mean, it feels like a lot of times when you hit stuff, it's just luck.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, you have three lives and you can choose whether or not like your lives correspond to your balls, I guess you could call them.
Nice. Nice.
There's a soundbite for you. But yeah, so if you want, you can have all three of your balls.
This is, are you telling me three balls? You telling me this is like a Total Recall type situation?
No. Yeah, this is gonna, this is going downhill pretty quickly. So, anyways, you can have three balls out at once, but the catch is if you lose all three of them, then you're dead because those are all three of your lives gone in one shot. But having three balls hitting stuff all at once, that gives you more points. And then you can also, you can choose whether or not you want to suck or blow.
Yes.
So
fuck you.
It's like kind of like some gravity. It's like a gravity control a little bit, so you can influence the way the ball goes.
Are you saying that he could have said attract/repel, and yet for some unknown reason decided to go with suck or blow?
But that's actually what it's referred to in the game.
Really?
What, did you make this game?
So yeah, get Shatter if you want to choose how you suck or blow on your ball.
Fuck
you. Fucking ashamed.
And with that, I leave you.
John, how much did you pay for Shatter?
$4.
Oh, that's a great deal.
Yeah, it's a great deal. And believe me, just the fact that I'm able to talk about it the way I have on this podcast makes it more than worthy of a purchase.
Come to think of it, Megatron didn't make that many dick jokes.
Although he could have, I mean, look at him.
He's a walking dick joke. Yeah. And also, I don't remember James ever firing John off at any point.
Well, you weren't at PAX last year.
Well, no, to be fair, John fired himself off of the bed.
There it is again. It's apocryphal at best.
Apocryphal my ass.
It literally, John, you can hear you falling off the bed.
On the drunk cast. Yeah, you can. Actually, I can't remember the name of it right now, but there's a brick breaking game on DSiWare that I'm very interested to try out, and it's probably going to be one of the first things I get. It's the one where it's like a brick breaking RPG, and it has like procedurally generated levels, and I can't remember the name of it, but it sounds so cool, and I know Neil loved it.
Alpha Bounce?
Yes, Alpha. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I'm definitely going to check that out on 3DS. Okay, well, that's going to wrap up new business. Now we're going to take a break. When we come back, we might talk a little bit about the Sony NGP, and then we'll get into your listener mail, so stick around. Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com. This week in community features, we have announced a GoldenEye 007 Wi-Fi night. It's happening on February 7th. Be sure to join us online and shoot other NWR readers in the face during our GoldenEye night. You can win copies of James Bond video games and GoldenEye t-shirts, so be sure to sign up in the TalkBack thread that's in the forums. And we have a blog by Carly. This is actually really cool if you're one of our European listeners. It's the UK 3DS Best Pre-Order Prices. Carly hips us to the best deals on the 3DS in Great Britain. bargain hunters will want to check this one out.
Next up in a torrent of content from our benevolent new director, Neil first of all reviews Tron Evolution for DS. Will fans of the movie want to take this game on the go with them? Neil lets you know about that. And next, he has impressions of the forthcoming Mario Sports Mix, where he shares his thoughts after some hands-on time with it. Find out if it lives up to the other stellar Mario Sports titles.
So we have more Neil. He has impressions of Monster Tail for the DS, which is a Metroidvania game. And we have a review from Pedro for Kingdom Hearts RE Coded, the worst name game on the DS, which is formerly an episodic cell phone game.
I don't even know why I write scripts for you, James. I should just give you bullet points.
As he slips Metroidvania under his breath.
Yeah. It's also made by the same guys that made Henry Hatsworth, but that's not important.
Yes.
So says James. On the review front, Carl gives us a review of UDraw. He graces us with a review of THQ's Touch Tablet, letting us in on the quality of its games and whether or not it's worth its rather high price tag. And in the longest feature name that we could possibly come up with, the Super Street Fighter 4 3D Edition Roundtable Transcript. We give you the entire transcript from the Street Fighter Roundtable held at the 3DS preview event. Check out what madman Yoshinori Ono has to say about the series.
There's also one for the Dead or Alive, but Ono's is much funnier. He is a crazy person.
All right, well, you'd be crazy not to check out all this fantastic original content over at NintendoWorldReport.com. And we're back. It's the second segment of the show. Actually, let's quickly talk about the Sony NGP, the next generation portable.
It sounds like an economic indicator.
Yeah, it's a code name. They're going to change it.
In many ways, I'm sure it will be.
I think it's just an indication that they don't want to call it PSP2 for market reasons, probably.
It's going to be called the Pui.
So they've not named it, dated it, or priced it yet, essentially, is what
I
we're
think they'll
with.
End up coming up with something like the Sony Nexus, or, I mean, I know that's taken, but something like that, something that sounds
the
cool.
The Sony Gizmodo?
The Kaz?
It'll have PlayStation written on it, but they might call it something different.
I give you the Sony Harai. Wait a minute.
Well, I mean, it's a pretty nice-looking system. They didn't announce the price. It sounds like it'll be out in Japan at least by the end of this year, probably maybe not outside Japan until 2012. But it's the form factor is similar to the original PSP, except it's bigger. The screen's 5 inches. It's a pretty damn big screen for a handheld. I think that's bigger than an iPhone screen even.
Yeah, it's notably bigger than an iPhone screen.
And it's OLED, which means, well, it's organic LED. Mm-hmm. And I think it means it kind of runs cooler, it uses less power than a typical LCD screen, and also is easy to look at in natural light, which is rare for a handheld. It's hard to look at any LCD screen in sunlight. And I think it's supposed to be good for that. And it's supposed to have a really good viewing angle, too, which you certainly can't say about the 3DS.
Yeah.
So, you know, the screen looks fantastic. It has dual joysticks, which are, they're more like actual sticks than either the PSP nub or the circle pad on 3DS. They do stick out a little bit, and they have an arm to them. And it has so the main screen is a touch screen, but it also has this touch pad on the back that you can kind of use with your, and I've been holding my hands up in front of me and trying to imagine holding this thing, because it's like 7 inches wide.
Yeah.
And then you've got your, you know, you're holding it with probably at least your index finger on the back, and then you're like reaching out with your middle fingers and like stroking it or something in the middle to do things. It's really odd.
So the games they showed had people poking. So they would use the tips of their fingers to sort of poke a surface on the back.
Mm-hmm.
So they were like pinching things by pressing the front and back.
Oh yeah, that's one of the things. I mean, because it has two touch surfaces, you could, you know, yeah, you can make it to where you you touch both at the same time to pinch things. But I think for the most part, it'll be used to kind of move cursors around without having to obscure the screen itself, you know, which is kind of nice. It fixes one of the problems with DS and 3DS, which has always been that, you know, if you've got your finger or your stylus over the screen, then you're blocking part of the screen. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of nice that now there's they still have the touch interface, but they can do it sort of in a way that you're not blocking any of your view. And that's neat. And they still has an actual touchscreen, too, for certain things.
Yeah, I mean, you could do some cool stuff with games where you could have sort of, you know, depth where you can, you know, with the touchscreen on the top, you can touch one surface, and underneath it, you can touch a different surface on the bottom.
Hmm.
Yeah, the only concern I have there is, like Johnny was discussing, not just reaching with the fingers, but keeping the unit stable.
Yeah.
It's a weird way to sort of interface with a system. I mean, I think it's a nice alternative to having two screens, because on, you know, on DS and 3DS, basically the idea is that if you don't want to obscure the screen, you can use the touch screen and then sort of map whatever's going on down there to some kind of visual indication on the top screen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it'll be even more of that with 3DS because only the top screen is stereoscopic.
Right. Exactly.
It also has these kind of motion controls in there that's basically, the back pad is basically the end of originality in terms of input.
Yeah. Six axis makes a triumphant return, though.
No!
You know, I'm looking for Lair 2. That's the thing that's going to be the killer app for it.
No, well, 3DS does all that stuff, too. It's a pretty standard feature on any kind of handheld system nowadays. I mean, my iPod Nano has an accelerometer in it, which is damn near useless, but it has one because they're so cheap. Yep. You just throw them into everything now. And with gaming, you know, it has potential applications, especially since this thing will play some Android games, which is kind of odd. But the graphics look really nice, and, you know, it does have things like, I think it has a microphone, it has a camera on both the front and the back. It's weird because I think you're now seeing the influence of the DS and its success over Sony's design philosophy, you know, with their next generation PSP. It now has these tons and tons of features that are basically copied from the DS.
Well, I mean, it's not like this is that's new behavior or anything.
No.
I mean,
Sony's next gen is always last gen, in that they put stuff in their next gen stuff that made money for people last gen. That nobody cares about anymore.
They try to do it bigger, better, badder.
But if you ask Sony, they were already doing it 10 years ago, but they just didn't put it in for whatever reason.
The funniest thing, I think, actually, is that the new handheld from Sony uses flash memory cards for games instead of UMD.
Yeah.
And the graphic that they showed looks almost exactly like a DS game card going into the system.
Yeah, they've created a new proprietary format of storage.
Sure, which, you know, Nintendo's doing again with 3DS as well.
Yep. Sure.
So that's normal. But it certainly seems preferable to UMD, which had, you know, all these moving parts, and it's loud, and it takes up more power, etc.
Yeah, I mean, really, I think this thing should be called the Sony They Were Right, because it's kind of like... They were right about UMD sucking. They were right about, you know, the touchscreen. They were right about this.
Cameras.
I mean, it's just pretty much like they're taking everything that worked on the DS.
Yeah, but it's still, you know, what it is doing, as the PSP did back in 2004-5, is going really super powerful, you know, nearly up to the current console generation kind of powers. And Nintendo haven't done that with 3DS, that's for sure.
Well, some of the games looked impressive. Some of them didn't.
But I mean, just in terms of resolution, like, it's sub HD, but, you know, some games don't really run in 720p. Like, you know, some of these, like, especially, like, I think, like, PS3 version of Red Dead, for instance, is actually sub HD and uprated. Call of Duty, yeah.
Yeah, none of the Call of Duty games run at 720p. They all run at, like, 6 something.
So it's pretty much there, you know. I mean, that's where this the next generation portable is. So that seems plenty to be honest, in terms of power.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it's inevitable that we have the discussion on cost, because we've already had it with the 3DS.
But the difference here is it's inevitable that Sony will sell it at a loss. The question is, how much of a loss are they willing to absorb? And how much of a loss are they willing to absorb in different markets? It's interesting Johnny said, we think it's going to be coming out at the end of the year, perhaps in Japan, if nowhere else. But Japan isn't as ready, in a way, because PSP's still doing well, whereas it is dead as a doorknob in the Western market.
Maybe they'll launch it here first.
I wouldn't say that the PSP is still doing well in Japan. I would say it came alive very, very late in Japan. Because it wasn't doing well there for a long time.
Well, that's the point. But even more so, if it's on an upswing.
That's what I'm saying. It's like it just launched in a way. I mean, yeah.
But I think the point would be in Japan, perhaps they're quite happy to see it at a really premium price because, you know, they feel like, you know, well, if people aren't willing to pay that, they'll be quite happy to pick up a current model PSP. Whereas, you know, in America, I don't know how high they can afford to go. You'd think they might like to get in around $299, where it's somewhat higher than the 3DS, but at the same time, you could say it does so much more stuff.
And I mean, especially when people are already saying, hey, the 3DS at $250, I don't really know if I'm going to pick it up at launch because it's cost too much money.
Right, and I think that the secondary part is the 3DS at least has a wow factor to it that the PSP doesn't necessarily, or
NGP.
I can't call it that because there's already an NGP, the Neo Geo Pocket.
Just say that Sony thing.
Yeah, I mean, the NGP is already taken by handhelds.
The Super Oval. Just call it the Super Oval.
Yeah, the Super Oval. So during their press conference, they had a slide with a picture of it and the big words, Super Oval Design.
Yep.
Which is basically like Sony can't get out of an announcement without saying something stupid as hell.
Sod.
Super Oval Design.
I think it's going to make E3 a lot more interesting and exciting. Yeah. Because these things will be in full-on competition. I mean, 3DS will be out by E3, but everybody will be like, okay, where are the games that I'm going to be wanting to play on this by Christmas? And everybody's going to be, hey, Sony, what's the deal with this thing? How much does it cost? Why do I want to buy it?
Yeah.
So it's going to be a lot of fun watching that happen.
If you go to 3DS, you know, people will say, well, it's all well and good, this stereoscopic 3D stuff, but at the end of the day, it's optional. And we haven't really seen game designers make incredible new experiences with stereoscopic 3D yet. And the games that are currently in the offing don't really seem to offer that. Yeah. So does 3DS merely constitute a situation where instead of, you know, what happened on the DS, you're just going to get console type games provided to you on a portable setting with stereoscopic 3D, which might actually make its appeal less unique than its predecessors. But with the PSP, the new one, that problem is even greater because it's literally, I mean, we've already had it on the original PSP where it's like, well, it's got Motor Storm like the PS3 and it's got Killzone and it's got Little Big Planet. And then with the new one, it's like going to be pretty much exactly the same thing, except now it's closer. And I don't think, especially in the American market, there is just no proven demand to play the same games as on your console, but portably.
Yeah.
In Japan, it may do.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, in North America, if you want to play console-style games, you will actually stay in your home and play console-style games.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, if you've spent a lot of money on a high-end audiovisual setup that you're very happy with, you know, you could probably want to make use of that, you know, with full surround sound or something.
And that's much less common in Japan.
Yeah.
People don't have room for that stuff.
Well, what is interesting to me, though, is that they didn't really announce much.
It was basically all, here's a bunch of features. And, you know, from that standpoint, it looks really cool. From a tech standpoint, I can see this thing being, and the screen alone is gorgeous. I mean, that is very classy technology. And I think fits the role of, you know, being a portable game player that you might be playing outdoors or in unpredictable lighting conditions. And it's more power efficient than, certainly more than what the 3DS is doing. 3DS.
Yeah, that is a shocker that we're going to have this super duper Sony handheld and its battery life. I mean, nothing confirmed yet, but the early indications are it's probably going to be somewhat better than the 3DS.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, 3DS has three screens. And that Sony thing has one, and it's a hyper-efficient screen at that.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it has no moving parts, which was one of the major problems with the PSP. It was a very interesting announcement. I was watching it over at NeoGAF, and people were just jizzing all over the page, you know, about how incredible they thought it looked. And I thought, you know, I think it looks really neat, but I don't know what I would play on this thing, and I doubt I'll be able to afford it. it's certainly more appealing to me than the original PSP because it just looks better designed.
Yeah.
But I don't know why it exists. It looks like, hey, you got some DS up in my PSP, and we made it way more powerful and way more expensive.
Well, it's kind of just the love child of the DS and the PS3.
Yeah.
I guess ultimately I look forward to playing John Lindemann's PSP2 at PAX East 2012.
Pretty much.
And you probably will be.
You can look forward to playing Chōganiki Zero on it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It is compatible with PSN titles for download.
Sweet. I'm interested in what they have in mind, but I'm not sure they learned the right lessons from the PSP.
It doesn't look like they did.
No, it just seems like a product without an audience.
Yeah. It doesn't seem like Nintendo necessarily learned the right lessons from the PSP.
Because
either.
Again, I mean, if you look at PSP success in Japan, one of the explanations would be that a lot of Japanese developers haven't necessarily come to grips all that well with the HD, you know, software development paradigm.
Sure.
And the PSP is an environment that they're a bit more comfortable with because it's, you know, on par with the previous generation's console tech. So to move the goalposts on them might not really be what they want. And of course,
hey, those guys are going to have to learn eventually.
Well, yeah, sure. But I'm just saying, in terms of building on what strengths the PSP has in Japan, it's right. I'm not sure that it's really doing that.
Well, yeah, I mean, you can look at what games come out on the PSP, and there's exclusively, and there's a lot of titles from smaller developers, like Nipponichi, who they put their games on the PSP because they can do them on the cheap, essentially, and that's not going to work now.
Yeah, and the 3DS, of course, is nuzzling into that little gap.
If 3DS games are 30 to 40, what are Neo Geo Pocket games going to cost?
Yeah, really.
Oh, they'll be $50 plus.
You can't take somebody else's abbreviation. You just can't do that.
Well, anyway, I mean, the purpose of us bringing this up wasn't to troll Sony's new handheld.
No.
I just thought it was interesting, and there's so many fascinating comparisons. It's a very different approach to what Nintendo's doing with 3DS, and I really do think E3 is just going to be this knockout.
Well, it
fest.
Is very different, but it is at the same time. They're both pushing in that more console-like direction, and we'll see how that flies outside of Japan.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's get into emails. The address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com, and James has the first letter.
Brian writes, "Hey guys, I recently listened to a variety of other podcasts giving their end-of-the-year accolades, and I was surprised by how little of the games listed I played this year. Assassin's Creed Brotherhood, Red Dead Redemption, Mass Effect 2, just to name a few. I was also surprised how many of the Nintendo games that would have made my top-of-the-year list got very little mention. I was expecting Super Mario Galaxy to take a lot of awards, Donkey Kong Country Returns to be in the running for a number as well, and Kirby's Epic Yarn to get some acknowledgement too. Instead, it seemed that Nintendo titles were barely mentioned, and when it was categories like Best Wii Games, there was much less thought placed in picking a winner. When Giant Bomb was picking their favorite downloadable game of the year, one of them mentioned Bit Trip Runner, but then stated that he was thinking of 3D Dot Game Heroes and asked if that was downloadable. Craziness. Although 3D Dot Game Heroes was pretty sweet. Anyway, I love your guys' podcast because it seems to completely align with my tastes. I like to play games on a variety of systems, but usually focus on Nintendo titles. Where I doubt any other podcast mentions Euphoria's existence, when Johnny gave it a glowing mini-review, I went ahead and downloaded it and thoroughly enjoyed it. Take care and keep up the great work."
All right, well, thanks, Brian, for the props, and I'm glad you like Euphoria, but I wanted for us to read this letter because I think the whole game of the year thing is interesting because I had a lot of the same thoughts, in particular listening to the Giant Bombcast, which I really like, but damn, they are fucking ignorant of most of the stuff on Wii and DS, and we can confirm was not much better, unfortunately, despite our own Billy Berghammer's involvement over there. Although Billy's been trying to evangelize fluidity due to pressure from me, so I appreciate him. And he's been calling out NWR, too, on Weekend Confirmed, so that's pretty cool. But I think that it's really sad that a lot of these other sort of multi-platform sites aren't very aware of what's going on. And particularly in the download space, I'm not surprised. I mean, with stuff like BitTrip Runner, the sad fact is that by anyone's reasonable, you know, recognition, that is one of the best downloadable games of 2010. I think even if you don't like it, you have to respect it, and you have to see how tight that game is and how well it's put together, and it should at least be up for consideration. And unfortunately, I think it comes down to a lot of, you know, how shitty the Wii Shop is, how hard it is for people to find things, the fact that even now there hasn't, I don't think there's a demo for Runner. There's been demos for Fate and now Beat, which is a year old, more than a year old. But I just don't think many people have played Bit Trip Runner, and that's terrible, because it's a fucking sick game.
Yeah, it's great.
And I mean, it would easily be, you know, one of my, it's probably between that and Super Meat Boy for me for like best downloadable game of the year. And then maybe VVVVVVVVVVV. So, yeah, you know, I think that's not surprising. And Galaxy 2, I bet you guys have some thoughts on why that maybe was forgotten.
I don't know. There's a bigger schism going on.
You look at the reviews for Galaxy 2, I mean, they were overwhelmingly positive. They were much sure. more positive than I expected them to be, because they rivaled the first one or even surpassed them in some cases. You know, whereas I kind of expected people to say, oh, it's pretty much as good, or it's better in some ways, but it's not as fresh. And maybe the overall feeling was just a little notch below. But that generally wasn't the way it went. You know, a lot of people seemed completely overflowing in their praise for it when it was reviewed. But that's somewhat different from when it then goes into the conversation for Game of the Year. And I think it probably suffers from perhaps not being as played amongst like the editors of a given organization. You know, the person who reviewed it, who might be more apt to play a Mario experience, would have given it a very, very fine review. But did everyone else play it? And if they did, do they think of it commensurably with these other experiences? I think where it probably runs into trouble for something like Game of the Year is that there's some of these tangible factors that you could point to a game pushing boundaries, be they sort of technical or narrative or gameplay-wise. Those tend to be, a lot of the time, what people gravitate towards.
So, Greg, you're talking around this a little bit, but I think the key here might be that Galaxy 2 doesn't really have a story.
Yeah, I think that's part of it.
Well, it wouldn't matter if it came out in November. You know, it'd be fresh on everybody's mind, and they'd remember the great experience they had with it. But when it comes out in April or May, and it doesn't have a story that you can actually think back and connect to in some way, I think it's harder because, I mean, the appeal of Galaxy 2 is very abstract. It's a very abstract game. And the appeal of it is very abstract. It's almost hard to put into words. And so it makes it hard to even remember, much less talk about, when you get around to Game of the Year stuff. And I think something like, you know, Assassin's Creed Brotherhood, which is basically Assassin's Creed 2-2, it connects with people more. I mean, it did come out much later, so it's fresher in people's minds. But it's a very redundant, you know, kind of iterative experience over...
Yeah, I'm surprised to hear that actually got serious consideration.
I was too.
People love that game.
Even if it's really good, I'm just...
But that's just from a conceptual point of view. I haven't played it, obviously.
Yeah,
I'm just talking
either.
About... Because of, I would have thought that would fall victim to some of the same things that we talked about with Galaxy.
Mm-hmm. And I think the main difference is it has a, you know, Assassin's Creed has an interesting story that people are kind of into. And Miyamoto was like, take this shit out of the Mario series.
Well, I disagree, because I think the reason people really liked Brotherhood was the fact it created a compelling multiplayer experience.
That's not, when I heard people talk about it, that's, everybody was like, yeah, the multiplayer is great, but here's what's amazing. And they talk about the single player stuff. That's the main thing.
I think the reason it was still in their minds, though, was because it's different.
Well, and also there's the timing issue, again, as Johnny...
Sure.
Yeah, which you can't say about Red Dead. Red Dead was early.
But Red Dead is very story-driven. And people, when people talk about it, they talk about the story and the characters and the ending and all that stuff. And you can't talk about any of that with Mario. It just
Red Dead's also been kept alive by a flow of relatively large...
DLC.
DLC, and they kept a campaign going for it for quite a while.
It's true, the remarketing with Undead Nightmare stuff. I mean, I guess the point is that there's a lot number of reasons why you could have some more mindshare for some of these other HD titles when it comes to decision time. Mm.
I also think that, I think that to a large extent, a lot of the media outlets that make these lists, I really don't think that they take Nintendo seriously.
No.
I think that they just look at Nintendo as, oh, they make their little Kirby's Epic Yarn games, and they just kind of go over there and do their thing and make their fitness games and do that kind of Nintendo stuff that they do. But if you want the real cutting edge stuff, well, let me show you Red Dead and let me show you Mass Effect 2. That shit's amazing.
But see, I think that might feed back more into their readers, though, because, I mean, remember at E3, well, you weren't there, but at E3, we had Blood's comment of, we're giving Kirby's Epic Yarn the best visuals of the year. And the shitstorm that happened after that was amazing.
Oh, and he knew it would.
Game trailers, this is.
Yeah.
I read the talkbacks for that for like a month because they were so amazing.
Yeah.
The hate was just awesome. But I think there is a little bit of that within it, within the confines of the editorial staff.
Playing to the crowd, basically.
Keeping it real.
I don't think they're posing for the most part. I think the opinions they give when they do those awards are their honest opinions, but I think they're just, if not misinformed, underinformed of the games that are coming out on Wii. I think a lot of these games, even like Mario Galaxy 2, I guarantee there are a lot of people who just didn't play it. They're like, oh yeah, I need to get around to that, but since Wii is not part of their regular gaming rotation, you know, that maybe they have a Wii, but they don't use it very often.
It's not used habitually, so you don't.
It's one of those games that they keep meaning to play, but they never get around to it, so they hear from other people about how good it is, but then, you know, they're not going to vote for it.
But I think just the most fundamental reason I could think of is just, you know, when you're doing this kind of exercise, I mean, James has been through it a number of times, perhaps you'd agree with this, I don't know, but, you know, it's a bit of a fool's errand, really.
Yeah, it's...
And you're talking about, obviously, you know, these days, the output of the games industry in a year is massive and diverse. And to, you know, to think that you could sift through and have some sort of cast iron ranking based on, you know, how good these games are, you know, they give you such different things. They really aren't commensurable. But... No. What then sticks out when you're on this impossible task is things that seem important. And, you know, I think something like Red Dead, where it's a huge open world and a story in a setting that's quite different from the games that have been tackled in that way before with the Western setting and stuff, that probably just seems a lot more important to something that has no pretense other than to have fun, like Galaxy 2.
Let me bring my considerable reputation on this topic to bear here. The credentials that I bring here are unmatched. In the end, like Greg said, it's a fool's errand. You can't sit there and say, well, this is definitively the best, you know, action platformer game of 2010.
No, it's meant to be a consensus.
Mm-hmm. Right, and reaching consensus is very difficult. And, and sometimes you just go, all right, guess what? This game won. And then the studio's like, well, I don't know. I'm like, nope, we're done. That game won. Next topic. It's very difficult to burn through all the stuff you have to do, and there's a lot of time spent just discussing things that are insignificant, and oftentimes you kind of lose the forest for the trees. And to Greg's point about things that seem significant or important, my primary evangelism that took place during this past year's awards rigmarole was that I essentially refused to let Fragile Dreams not get an award. I mean, I basically drew a line in the sand and said, as the editor, this will not go live unless it wins something.
Which is tough because nobody else played it.
Exactly.
And I think the same thing happens with these multi-platform sites, because ultimately when you have games from one system competing against another system, the nod is probably going to go to the platform that people played the most. And if you work at a multi-platform site, I can almost guarantee that Wii is the console of the three that you play the least.
Well, and a lot of these games are on the other two.
Yeah, exactly. And that means that there's even a higher chance that multiple people have played them.
But to that point further, I picked that game and basically played gatekeeper with it. Because that game's approach to storytelling and world creation was... like, I'd never seen anything like that before.
Because you like Animu.
What's that thing to do with that? It's the fact that it built this world that I've not seen that kind of setting before.
Well, the point is that you found that worthy of recognition.
Right. It's not just that it was worthy of recognition, but that it hung around in the back of my head. So when it came time to discuss this, I'm going through experiences I had this year that were appreciably different. And that was one of the ones that came out.
Yeah, that's great. John, do you have any comments on this?
No.
No.
It's fine.
No, I mean, that's the thing. I just think that there definitely is, like, I wouldn't call it a Nintendo bias, but I just feel like a lot of these outlets, they try to pick a game of the year when really they've only played two of the three consoles and they really don't really care about.
But doesn't that go to the fool's errand part again? I mean, if you had someone who played stuff from the three, would they have played all of it? But are we then ignoring portables? Can a portable game not be game of the year? Was DQ9 not brought up in this conversation? I mean, there is so far to go down this rabbit hole.
Yeah.
Well, that's the problem. They're putting themselves out there like this is their list. And they're supposed to be experts. I mean, these people are getting paid for what they do.
Yeah, but just there's limitations to it for every outlet. Every outlet has its own unique limitations because of the people that work there and the kind of coverage they do. So just take it all for what it's worth and don't take it too seriously.
Well, they're getting paid to do it, man. You know, if they say we're gonna give you the game of the year and we're gonna tell you what we think is the game of the year.
It's what they think is the game of the year. It's not what they think everyone else thinks is the game of the year. You know, it's got to be personal on some level.
I'm just saying, like, you're just basically, I think you guys are letting people off too easy.
I mean, I'm kind of with John here. Like, just I think it comes down to there's a certain level of disinterest in the platforms of Nintendo that. And it, you know, maybe Nintendo's to blame. They haven't done enough to appeal to a certain group of people. But like I was listening to Vinnie Caravella talk about going to the 3DS event last week, and you know, I like Vinnie. I think he's a funny guy, but he was getting so many details wrong. I thought, I know way more about what happened at this event, what was announced, and what's actually going on with 3DS than this guy. And he was there, and he played it all day. That's sad. He's a smart guy. I just don't think he gives a shit. You know?
That's a question of professionalism. I mean, if you're paid to cover something, but I mean, all I'm saying is with this all game of the year stuff, I don't know how far professionalism goes. It's a kind of silly exercise anyway.
You're
and
right.
In the end, it can only come down to personal decision making or get a bunch of people in a room and you bang their heads together until they come out with something. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It just seems to me like if they don't have an interest of something, they don't have a knowledge of something, they can't really feign it. You know, that's just patronizing and it doesn't generate a fair result.
Right.
No, and that actually kind of goes to what Johnny was just talking about, because he didn't really have the knowledge base. And you could say that would be patronizing because it doesn't know what the hell he's doing, and you feel bad that you even care because he clearly doesn't. Now, one other point to bring up before I say we start tossing dirt on this coffin is that there are very concerted PR campaigns for Game of the Year awards. And we get some of the wash of them, but because primarily Nintendo does not engage in this kind of PR, we don't see it firsthand all that much. We got some from Activision pushing games for Game of the Year awards that I thought were laughable, but that's beside the point. And Nintendo doesn't do this. But we know that other developers do. So at the very least, they are at least somewhat involved in the lack of mindshare.
Yeah, they're not lobbying.
No. And every award in every arts industry has massive amounts of money spent lobbying.
Oh, the Oscars right now are in full swing, you know.
Yeah. Millions of dollars were spent lobbying for Oscars. Now, if somebody wants to spend millions of dollars lobbying for me to give them a Game of the Year award, I'll be more than happy to take it. I mean, I'll take it cash. You will win Game of the Year. If you give me $1 million cash, I don't care what we gave your game. You will win.
I don't think that's lobbying by definition, James.
That's bribery.
Yeah, let's move on. So the next letter is from Joseph, who writes, "Hey, RFN. First off, I've been studying communications and journalism for over a decade now. I feel your pain, dude. I'm close to a PhD with a dissertation on defining hardcore as it relates to game culture. I only mention this to lend credence to my opinion when I say you guys are the best gaming podcast I've heard. You're one of the few examples of media, gaming or otherwise, that does not appear to have an agenda or a crippling bias. No, your goal is to enjoy and discuss gaming, not fan the flames of the console wars or confuse an inability to be impressed with possessing high standards."
Well, that's sad this comes after our PSP2 discussion.
"Your discussions are intelligent and passionate without just deeming everything worst blank ever in comic book guy fashion, as many gaming outlets do. Please never stop. I look forward to each new episode. A few notes on Sonic as they relate to your last episode."
Worst series ever.
Number one, contrary to popular belief, the Werehog did not come out of left field. Just as Supersonic was a reference to Goku's Super Saiyan form in Dragon Ball Z, the Werehog is a reference to Goku's Uzaru or Great Ape form, a transformation which occurs when Goku sees a full moon. This is just another of the many Dragon Ball Z references from the Sonic universe. 7 Dragon Balls, 7 Chaos Emeralds, etc., etc. Now, really quickly, I think actually, Joseph, that it's maybe not a reference to Dragon Ball Z specifically, but maybe the Journey into the West legend from China, and, well, it's popular in Japan. I think it originally comes from China, and Enslaved, the video game Enslaved from last year is also based on that same legend.
There's a lot of culture based on Journey to the West.
Yeah.
Hundreds of books, TV shows, comics, movies, games.
Yeah, I'm really not that familiar with it. I'd kind of like to learn more about it, because I like Dragon Ball Z.
It's interesting. I've not read it all, but I've read parts of it.
So it's a book, originally?
It's like a series of folk novels. It's folklore.
Like The Odyssey, maybe.
Yeah, that's basically what it is. It's a Chinese epic poem, essentially.
Okay. Okay. All right, well, back to the letter. So, number two, I like Sonic. Remember, in the early 90s, the Poochie condition was too novel to be ridiculous. I think the continued, though inconsistent, success of the Sonic franchise is due to gamers like myself who have always enjoyed the games but aren't vocal enough to riot about its shortcomings. Also, I know Sega is happy selling Sonic to kids and leveraging his mascot status, but dozens of mascots have come and gone in the span of Sonic's run. No pun intended. And I just can't attribute that primarily to a cyclical duping of new audiences. Keep up the amazing work. Don't know what I'd do without you.
Are we talking about Sonic again?
Worst email ever.
No, this was an amazing... I mean, this guy is getting a PhD on the definition of hardcore in gaming culture. I mean, come on. That's... I can't believe if you actually finished that, dude. That's insane. I actually emailed this guy back and said, I want to read your dissertation. And you should let me, because you're not ever going to find many people who will ever say that.
No. No, you won't.
Very true.
But I would love to read this. I mean, it's... wow. That's a hell of an undertaking.
Yeah, really. Speaking of errands that seem... Almost.
Yes.
I
guess the argument here is that Sonic is secretly really good, and it's still popular because people love playing the games, not because of my theory, which is that it's kind of the Pokemon thing where people get sick of it, but then new people come in.
Yeah, but if that's not a bad example, because, I mean, the Pokemon games are actually good.
Yeah, that's the difference.
I mean, I know they haven't changed a whole lot, but...
But
yeah.
They're actually good. There is a
very solid, well-put-together game under all that.
Yes.
But, yeah, so, I mean, look, he makes a good point about just how few of those platform characters have endured. Obviously, Mario has very comfortably, and Sonic has, but I mean, very little else has survived.
Well, I would also say that a lot of the companies that had their own mascots back in the, you know, early, mid, late 90s don't exist anymore. Sega does. So I think that's part of the reason Sonic is still around.
Busby 3D.
Sega's still around.
I was thinking Bubsy too. That's hilarious. I was like, Bubsy.
I was just thinking of the YouTube video of somebody playing that going, get down!
Well, but I mean, even something like, I mean, they keep threatening to bring it back, but not actually doing it because Hudson can't seem to release that downloadable bonk game. But Hudson still exists, and the bonk
game. Well, Hudson exists less and less every day.
Yeah, Konami are about to own them completely. That is true.
Yeah.
As Konami slowly removes all the Hudson placards.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, bonk has sort of been around. I mean, he hasn't really had a new game in a long time, but certainly they've kept him alive through remakes for PS2 and GameCube, and then, you know, re-releases on Virtual Console.
And again, I mean, he's been around a lot longer than he ever deserved to be, ever.
Sure.
And that is because Hudson is still around, so.
I think the incredible thing about Sonic is that Sega's been so prolific with the Sonic releases. I mean, they've never had to bring back Sonic.
Yeah.
Sometimes they pretend that they're doing that, Even though, like, didn't you release 3 Sonic games last year? No, Sonic's back. Haven't you heard?
See, the best part about that, though, was they're like, all right, we learned our lesson. We're not going to make a bunch of Sonic games.
Yeah, they're like going to, or like, the bad ones that we've already released are going to be jettisoned into the Phantom Zone. Or whatever. Yeah,
we're going to take them off the website and not talk about them anymore. Here's 3 new Sonic games. It's like, no, you can't do that. That's not how it works.
It is Sonic's 20th anniversary this year, so expect a deluge of Sonic stuff this year. Perhaps even all the Genesis games on a Wii disc in a box.
Yep.
I can't imagine.
If we got a deluge of Sonic games, how could I tell the difference?
Well, I will say I actually got Sonic Colors in the mail today for the Wii, and I will be talking about it next week, and I hope it's good. I'm looking forward to trying it out.
I enjoyed it, you know, not immensely.
Trying to be as open-minded as I can about a series that's been around for 20 years. Anyway, could you read the next letter, Greg?
Yes, Red Herring from Buckinghamshire, UK writes, "Good evening, chaps. I just wondered if any of you had any thoughts on the upcoming royal wedding involving Kate Middleton and Prince William. I am an avid listener and am keen to hear your thoughts. This would be great if you could discuss your opinions, as I am rather keen to hear them after all. John's opinion on the matter is of special interest, since he is, after all, a recent deportee of the British Commonwealth. Keep up the fine work."
Which one of you wrote this?
You know, Red, me, man.
Red Herring. I mean, goodness gracious.
Come on. The name is a play on Red Herring.
I wish
Herring.
It was me, honestly. I really wish it was me.
This has
I
to
think
be
it
fake.
Was Greg. I
like,
think
if it was me at this point, I would be on the floor just giggling.
Is Buckinghamshire even a real place in the UK, Greg?
Yes, it is a real place.
Right. Okay, just making sure.
It does sound a little.
Just making sure you had a good cover story for this one. Yes, I wish Kate Middleton and Prince William all the best.
Me too. They seem like a darling couple.
Dude, Mr. Herring. What the fuck?
Greg, what are your thoughts? This affects you much more directly than
absolutely,
it does us.
Absolutely, yeah.
What are my thoughts? Well, first of all, we're getting a public holiday out of it. The Prime Minister has declared that there will be a public holiday. It'll extend like an existing weekend holiday or something. So
we can't even get a holiday for voting, and you get it for like a wedding?
They're rare.
This is the heir to
the throne getting married. This is not just for Johnny on the street.
I can totally see that because, you know, the royal family's like, they're such a unique part of British culture.
So you're saying it's as big as a Dragon Quest game coming out in Japan?
Yes. I just look at it very simply. You deal with two young, very attractive, photogenic people who are happy together and wish to commit the rest of their lives to each other. So I can't relate to it at all. So best of luck.
Break a leg.
And it is pertinent to John, because one day you will belong to William as you belong to Elizabeth now. Oh, anytime we like, we could just call it in, John. You're like a sleeper agent.
Wow.
Do I belong?
John, the Manchurian candidate, Lindemann,
no,
is that what you're telling
he's
me?
He's the Manchesterian candidate. Okay, thanks for the letter, Redder. So now John's going to read the last question for this week.
All right, Nathan from Toronto writes, "Hello again." This is in 3 parts, by the way. Number 1, Johnny, in response to my praise of DKC Returns in episode 227, you recommended Donkey Kong Jungle Beat. I have been thinking about trying this game for some time now, but I have little desire to obtain a rather cumbersome peripheral due to lack of space in my apartment. In your opinion, will I lose a terrible amount of the quote-unquote experience if I play the new Play Control version on Wii instead? Number 2, how is it that none of you guys have mentioned Scott Pilgrim yet? I love the comics, but if that isn't your bag, you've got to have watched last year's movie. In my opinion, it is the best video game movie ever made. Yes, you heard me right. While not actually based on a game, most video game movies are trying too hard to be movies to justify their existence that they leave out the video game part. Scott Pilgrim vs. the World gets it right, and the Nintendo content alone ought to at least be worth a mention on the show. Your thoughts, please. Number 3. Lastly, here is a recommendation if you've got 500 points to kill on your Wii. Tomina Sanner. Get it. Play it. Experience the madness. If anything, John has absolutely got to try this due to the funky content alone. While BitTrip Runner has a tremendous amount of charm due to its retro graphics and electronic music, Tomina Sanner is just absolutely bonkers in regards to its content. You'll start dancing with a bunch of Japanese schoolgirls or moonwalk through a raging astronaut.
I do that all the time.
Yeah.
Wow, okay, so first off, for Jungle Beat, I have not personally played the new Play Control version. I've heard it's not great. I know they added a couple levels, but I've heard kind of mixed reviews on the quality of those, and the actual controls don't sound very good. No. So I would say, and surely you can find the GameCube version for really cheap.
It is the bongos, though, isn't it? It's the thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, see, if you have access to a GameStop, they have bongos. They have lots of bongos, because people, for some reason, thought, hey, let's buy these damn things.
Well, they only work for, like, two games in America.
And then, well, so. It's worse than that, though, because then Pelican went and made third-party bongos, because the world needed that. So now you can walk into a GameStop, and they'll have them stacked up in the corner for, like, $2. Because they take up space.
Go get you some bongos, and when you're done with the game, get rid of them at GameStop like everybody else.
You get 50 cents for them.
They won't clog up your apartment. But I do think that even if there was never a new Play Control version anyway, I think that playing Jungle Beat with the bongos is a sublime experience. And it may not kick in at first, but I think as you play the game and you learn to play the game the proper way, it will make sense to you, because the thing about it is, and I'm sure Greg will back me up on this at least, is that Jungle Beat is a combo-based platformer, which is probably not something you've ever really played before, although when it's played correctly, it almost has the rhythm of like a BitTrip Runner, maybe a little bit slower, but it's more freeform than that, and you have a lot more choices to make. And the nice thing about it is that the levels are designed so that there are all these elements, whether they're like vines or jump springs or enemies that you can bounce off of or even walls that you can bounce off of. But the levels are designed in such a way that if you play it really well, you're almost playing to the beat of the music, and the fact that you're playing it by rhythmically tapping on these bongos fits it so perfectly that it's an incredible experience, and it's really strange. I mean, it doesn't seem like it would work, but it totally does. And I think the game would be lessened by playing it with a typical controller.
Yeah, I agree. I haven't played the other version either, but I think it's very perfect the way it is. I wouldn't want to change it. The only thing is, don't actually clap.
No, just tap on the side.
There's a clap command. Don't do that. Just tap on the side. It works just very, very reliably that way. The recognition's fine.
I think that the biggest issue with the new Play Control, and I'm not really all that familiar with either particular version, is that it comes from the height of the Waggle era. And I think that's what you really need to keep in mind.
I mean, the new Play Control series is up and down. I mean, I think the...
It's not really that much of a series.
Yeah.
With seven games in Japan.
Yeah, I mean, Pikmin and Metroid turned out well. I've heard Chibi Robo is pretty good, although that's Japan.
Yeah, I like Chibi Robo.
You know, I've heard the Mario Tennis is not good. And Jungle Beat is the one game out of all those that when they said they're bringing it to new Play Control, I thought that's not going to turn out well. Because that is not a game that seems like it would benefit whatsoever from Wii controls. And the fact that they shipped it, not even giving you the option of plugging in your bongos and using those, even though it's completely possible on a technical basis,
yep.
They didn't even give you that option, I think is just horrible.
Yeah.
Horrible.
Well, that's kind of, yeah, similar to, funnily enough, DKCR, like just not being able to use your classic controller. It's similar sort of stubbornness, isn't it? Did they call him Donkey Kong because they thought that kind of meant that he was stubborn?
Yeah,
it seems like they're terribly donkey-ish about everything that goes on with that franchise.
But yeah, go find a cheap copy of Jungle Beat and play it with the bongos. I think you'll understand why it's played with the bongos once you try it. Maybe not at first, but give it an hour. Watch the videos that they show you. They really teach you how to play the game. Dude, it's so good. Keep in mind, this is made by the people who made Mario Galaxy 1 and 2. It's that good. Really, I like it just as much as Galaxy 1 and 2. I think Jungle Beat's incredible. Scott Pilgrim, how many of us have seen it?
Seen it.
I haven't seen it.
I haven't seen it.
So John and I have both seen it. I've talked about it plenty on Box Office Poison. So if you want to hear my full thoughts, go over there. And plus that of a bunch of ex-RFN guys. But I like it. It's not one of my top movies of the year, but I thought it was really fun. And I like the comics, too. I like the comics better, really. But I thought the movie adaptation was quite good. And I cannot argue with your assessment that it is the best video game movie.
Yeah, I mean, I really liked it. I wasn't, you know, blown away by it. I thought it was good.
But you like the original Mortal Kombat movie better?
I do like that movie.
Anything with Jean-Claude Van Damme, I like better.
That's Street Fighter. That's Street Fighter, yeah, John. Get it straight.
Raul Julia is rolling over in his grave.
Yeah, oh God, Raul
Yeah,
Julia.
You were thinking of Christopher Lambert, I believe.
Yeah.
The Danish Jean-Claude Van Damme.
But yeah, I thought, anyways, back to Scott Pilgrim, because I don't want to talk about
it. I don't know what he is. After the nationality clusterfuck apocalypse of the Highlander movies, I don't know where anyone comes from anymore.
All right. So
yeah, it was good. It almost kind of lost me there at the start, you know, because the first kind of dance battle he has with that guy, I was like, where is this really going? Is it going to be a musical? You know, it was looking pretty lame after that, but it actually got a lot better as it went on, I thought. At the start, I thought it was a little bit over the top, a little bit too video gamey, like using like the effects and everything is kind of like a gimmick.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I thought it got a lot better as it went on.
A lot of that stuff is actually straight out of the comic. I mean, the comic has one-up blocks all over the place and coins, yeah. And you know, there's a lot of River City Ransom references in both.
Yep.
One of my favorite jokes from Scott Pilgrim, and this was actually not in the comic, so they wrote this specifically for the movie. The guys are sitting around practicing. They're rehearsing in their band. And the girlfriend, Knives Chow, she's sitting on the couch with this other guy who's not actually in the band. He's just kind of their fan, and he hangs out there. His name is Young Neil. And she says, "So what do you play?" And his answer is, "Oh, you know, the usual Legend of Zelda, Final Fantasy, Mario." That's pretty good. I mean, yeah. I really like that. And yeah, I mean, the thing is, Scott Pilgrim is not about video games. It's about people who are way into video games and talk about them on occasion.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's great. It's unfortunately did terribly at the box office, but it's out on Blu-ray and DVD now.
Yeah.
So you should go check it out if you haven't seen it. If you're listening to the show, you'll probably really like Scott Pilgrim.
Yeah.
I'd say that's a very good bet, actually.
I got a kick out of it.
What was the third thing here? Oh, Tamina Sanner. It sounds awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I checked with Nathan after this because I'd heard of it, but I didn't really know much about it. But it is kind of similar to Bit Trip Runner, but he told us that it's not nearly as difficult or as demanding, and it's just way crazier. So for $5, it's probably better than Muscle March.
That's hard to say.
Okay, well, thanks everybody for the great emails. The address, again, is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. We'd love to hear from you. Send in questions, comments, shout-outs, whatever you want. We'll read them. I can't read everything on the show, but we do read all the emails we get, and we really appreciate everybody who writes in. Now it's time to end the show. Before we go, a little update. Next week, hopefully, we're going to start talking about Ogre Battle 64 for Retroactive. So if you haven't started playing the game yet, be sure to do that. We've all started, right, guys?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But yeah, it's a very interesting game. There's a pretty active discussion going on in the forums right now. So if you are already playing along, be sure to go join in on that.
It's mostly strategy right now in there.
Yeah, it's a strategy game. So
if you're kind of lost, that might there's people in there who are to make me feel unknowledgeable about this game.
Scary. So that's going to be Ogre Battle 64. And of course, a reminder, we will be at PAX East in March. Very excited. I believe the date is March 12th at 10:30 a.m. in the Cat Theater at the Boston Convention Center. So be there or be square, man. To answer everyone's questions, we will be recording it. At least audio, hopefully video as well, like we had last year.
Possibly in 3D.
But you can't get the real experience unless you're there. And, you know, you want to go to PAX East anyway. I'm sure 3DS is going to be there, a lot of games, a lot of other great
don't
panels.
Don't make any promises. Remember Nintendo's booth last year.
Well,
go to PAX East because it's fun.
It is fun. It's a crazy place.
Yeah.
And we're putting together all of our travel plans. It looks like there's going to be a big group of people there. I know that we will be talking with Carl and Mike Sklens, at least. And I think Stan Ferguson might even show up a little bit. So very excited to see all those guys and talk to them again. And hopefully we'll see and talk to you as well if you're listening to this. You can join us on Facebook. We're posting updates throughout the week on various little things. David O. has completed his quadrangle of character art for the four of us, which is really funny. And it looks like he put a lot of time and work into it. So I really appreciate that. And you can go check it out right now. And we'll have up photos and stuff like that from PAX East as well. We're over 200 fans on Facebook, and my goal is to have 250 by the time we get to PAX East. So if you can help us out, if you can tell people about it, please do. And of course, you can rate and review us on iTunes. That does help the show a lot, and we really appreciate it. If you've already done it, thank you very much. Finally, our sister podcasts are ongoing. The NWR Newscast is up to a weekly schedule now, so you can go over there and check out what they're doing every single week. And there's a new episode of Radio Trivia Podcast Edition, where TYP joins Zach Miller and plays some excellent game music, and they talk about games. It's a lot of fun, so make sure you check that out as well.
Shocking revelations.
Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll be back next week.
I would say that since we've dumped on this franchise pretty bad.
It's just that none of the four of us really like it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's just the way it worked out.
No, we all feel like it's the worst franchise ever. Yes, but...
I guess it shows the strength of a brand, really. I mean, yeah, once you have that brand, you can shit all over it as much as you want. People still
oh, Jesus,
it.
John.
Teflon Sonic.
I was trying to be conciliatory. Come on.
The thing is, it's part of marketing, and I think they put a lot more money into upkeeping that brand than they do ensuring the quality of the games, but that's apparently fine for them. And they're making an effort to improve the quality of the games. So, you know, good for them. Is that conciliatory enough? Can we move on?
I don't think it's conciliatory enough until we force John to play Sonic 06. Enjoy the fact there's a load time, a menu telling you what you have to do, and then another 30-second load time to start the game.
That's awesome.
I once went to an E3 theater presentation of Sonic 06.
Oh. Did you have to load 6 or 7 times in the
presentation?
Well,
of course, you must have thought you were going to see a comedy.
No, it was really bizarre. It was like a room with Sonic in there and then a bunch of rings, like, and it was basically a guy showing off the level editor because the game, they didn't have it like running in engine, like gameplay wise. They had the environment set up and everything, so this guy was like placing rings around the environment and just kind of spinning the camera around and just showing it off, but he wasn't really playing the game. It was one of the oddest demos I've ever seen.
You know why they did that, right? They were basically just hiding the flaws.
It's like, so you've been to hell, Johnny.